This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. We will be having a little introduction segment. After that, we're going to talk about deck building. Since we've focused on the store championships recently, we're going to talk about a setup analyzer. It's a great tool. After that, we're going to have a little bit of rules discussion revolving around setup. And then we're going to have an interview with Aaron Glazer, the winner of the DC store championship, and why he chose to bring Siege to that championship. And then finally, we're going to have some closing comments with something very special in them.
So, episode 5, and we've got some news this week, actually. First of all, that we got official recognition on the FFG site. Did you see that?
I did. I saw a beautiful article written by you on the site, and the recognition was the great writer of this article also hosts a podcast that Darknotch is part of. Bam!
There we Sweet. Go. I think that we might be the first podcast to get official mention on the FFG website.
It's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I was approached about writing an article, and so I submitted something. I hadn't seen it in a while, and they did some editing to it. But I'm quite pleased with the final result. It mostly says what I wanted to say, and it's a little more user-friendly than the version that I had submitted. So props to the gentleman at FFG who edited it, but also it's fun to see something aimed at a wide audience that I think was a fun article to write. Other news this week. As I'm recording this on Sunday, the Two Champs, One Chumps 150th episode was recorded today, live. It had a few hitches in recording it, which is a little unfortunate because of Google Hangouts and limits on the number of people, but they got around to it. They were handing out prizes. They had quite a few people listening live. And, you know, 150 episodes. I can only hope that we ever get anywhere near that.
Yeah, that's incredible. Like, these guys have given so much to the community, and they've worked so hard. Buy them beer when you see them at Gen Con or Worlds. They deserve it.
Yeah, no, definitely. They talked about some really interesting topics on air, live. And it's interesting to know because we record this, and we probably record about an hour and condense it down to 35, cutting out all the terrible, stupid things we say. And they can do it live, and it sounds very much like their podcast. You know, it flows easily. Wouldn't have to edit it as much. They're clearly better at this than we are.
Practice makes perfect, right?
Practice makes perfect. Well, I hope we get the chance to do that much practice. Final big item in news, and I mentioned this on our Facebook page, but while we were recording one of the sessions this week, Darknotch's wife went into labor. So, as like a good man, he finished recording the session with us. he's the proud owner. Owner's the wrong
proud
word. Proud
father.
Father of a new baby daughter. So, congratulations,
yeah.
John.
Yeah, Danny's healthy, so all is good.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear. I have one on the way, and to hear how calmly you handled the entire process gives me some reassurance.
Well, you know, the fourth time it's a lot easier than the first.
Right, so I'll suitably panic for
yeah, run around, scream, yeah.
Before we close off this intro segment and jump into the meat of the episode, I want to mention, please listen to the closing segments. We have an announcement about an upcoming episode I think you'll be very excited to hear, but I'm going to force you to listen to us talk for 30 minutes before you get there. John, both of our last episodes have been very well received, and both of them sort of centered around deck building. And there's one tool that we tend to use that we didn't get a chance to talk about at all. I'm sure you can already think about which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, this is probably the setup analyzer that the Mad Huntsman put online. It's a fantastic tool to see not only your setup, but what would be better for you. For instance, should you mulligan if you only have a 2-card setup, if you only have a 3-card setup, and maybe in some cases if you only have a 4-card setup? And this tool actually gives you all the information for that once you get the hang of how to use it.
Yeah, I think it's not hugely user-friendly, and it hasn't been wildly publicized, so you may never have heard of it, even if you are a veteran player. So I'll include the link in the chapter data. But this is a really, really handy tool, and I guess I first want to talk about how important setup is, because people tend to dismiss just how much of an impact you can have from this early game.
Yeah, because setup not only gives you resource advantage, but it also gives you card advantage in some cases. So if you can play, you know, even one or two more cards on setup than your opponent, you're gaining a one or two card advantage. It's that simple.
And it's not only that, it's that any advantage you have in setup magnifies through the game. So not only have you dig deeper through your deck and you're more likely to have found your answers, but if you have a Golden Tooth Mines on setup, from plot one, it's generating cards. If you have a gold location on setup, from turn one, it's generating gold.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goes for character board advantage. You have a higher board advantage, you have a much higher chance to be able to push through military challenges and keep that board advantage. So again, it really has a huge impact on the game.
Yeah, and I think a lot of players tend to underestimate how you can optimize your setup. There are a couple of factors. So first of all, there's the number of non-setup cards that you have in your deck. And a lot of people think of just events and attachments and like, this is how many events and attachments I have, and so I can have 12 or 14 or whatever they want to call it. But that's a gross oversimplification. I tend to play a lot of Greyjoy, and I have only on one occasion ever set up a newly made Lord.
Or an Iron Mines.
But I've never, actually, I don't know if I've ever set up an Iron Mines. And the reason these you don't set these up is because the reason they're in your deck is for an effect when they come into play.
Right, and it's not just Greyjoy that has these problems. Targ has a bunch of characters like that as well, where you want to play the character to remove, like, Joro or any other character, like, one of those attachments.
Blood Riders, Dragon Thieves.
Dragon Thief, thank you.
Targ is probably one of the situations where they're most often going to look at it and really have to make the call. Do I have two extra gold, do I set up this Dragon Thief and not use his ability, or am I going to need him? And it's a really interesting decision point.
Yeah, because you're thinking to yourself, it's two gold plus a card, and that's a lot. It can be a lot.
It certainly can. I think one of the best examples of how this setup analyzer can work is the Greyjoy Old Way deck that I built for a tournament a week and a half ago. I actually plugged that thing into the setup analyzer, and I found out that the optimal strategy for it was to mulligan if I had a four-card setup. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that every time I have a four-card setup, I'm going to mulligan to try and get better. But it means that if I have four cards, that's not enough for me to consider it a good setup. Because that deck will set up an average of 4.79 if I mulligan at four cards. And so if I have four really strong cards that I like to see against my opponent, I'm still going to keep that, even if I have three that has just the right cards to face my opponent. But if I have four that are fine, I'm going to mulligan, because chances are I'm going to have more than that.
So basically, I'm going to just describe very quickly how this tool works. You basically put in all your characters, and you put in the number of locations, and you mention whether it's limited. You'll actually see some things that can be a little bit complicated at first. You'll see number of uniques present in times 2, number of uniques present in times 3. This actually means the number of uniques. So if you had 3 the readers, for instance, you would just put a 1 in the number of uniques present in times 3 category under the cost of the reader. But the thing that I find the most interesting is you have, actually, like Alex was talking, a thing that says mulligan strategy, and that's where you can change it and see the number of results, and it quickly goes through hundreds of setups for you and tells you basically your average gold, your average flop, what your percent chance of getting a 0 to 7 card setup is. So the power of this tool is that you can not only see your setup, but it actually gives you a feel for your gold curve as well, because honestly, the more cards you're setting up gives you an indication that your gold curve is low or high, because the more expensive cards you're going to have, obviously, the higher your gold curve.
Yeah. Some of the other tools I want to point out within this thing, you know, it's taking into account, like we said, number of uniques, because you can't set up dupes and setup. It's taking into account number of limited cards, because you can only put one of those. But for instance, it takes into account the increased levies you have. Why? Because that's a setup card that can only attach if you have a location. You know, it's taken into account these other factors that you might not normally think of.
Like Obera Sand?
Yeah, like Obera Sand. The other thing that you can do with this is you can adjust it for things like House of Dreams. So you can change your gold for setup down to 3, your setup hand size down to 6, You could adjust it for Knights of the Hollow Hill. You could set your setup hand size to zero and your gold to zero. But I can tell you already what the results will be.
Not good.
Still, as John mentioned, though, it can be a little complicated to fill it out because you're not looking at it in the same way you look at a deck list. So it's always good to check. There's a calculate the deck size and make sure your deck size is right and you're not forgetting any cards before you move on to the simulations.
I'll give an example, actually, of a deck I put in recently. It's a Greyjoy deck I was fooling around with. And when I put it into the setup analyzer and I tell it to do mulligans if I set up two or less cards, it tells me that I have a 43% chance to set up three cards and a 41% chance to set up four cards. So an average of 3.7 cards and an average use of 4.34 gold. Now, if I'm actually to increase that to mulligan if I have a three or lower card setup, I actually get better returns. So now I'm using 4.37 gold, I'm getting 3.94 cards, and my percentages look way better. So this is actually a pretty big difference. And if I were to actually take it and tell it, no, I'm going to mulligan now if I have four less cards, I actually get worse. So I'm better off to stick with the three. And you can quickly see by just changing a single number, when is it best for you to mulligan, unless, like Alex was saying, you're getting these really key cards against your opponent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are cases in which I've ditched or mulliganed away a six-card hand, you know, or a six-card flop, because it just did not have any of the answers, and I couldn't reliably say I would draw into them. Now, this isn't a deck that would average four or more anyway, so I was fairly convinced I wasn't going to be mulliganing down to two. Yeah, so I think we should really give credit to the Mad Huntsman on Agot Cards for making this tool publicly available and publicly accessible. And I think it's really worth taking the 5 minutes it takes to put in your deck into there just to improve your knowledge of your deck and your efficiency and to be able to tweak that.
Absolutely. And it's amazing. I think the more you use it, the faster it is to put in the deck and the more useful you'll find it. I was talking with a few people the other day, and I'm going to admit to something. I was actually confused and probably wrong about something. That, like, never happens, you know, because I'm, no, wait, that's you. I'm always wrong. But basically, it was the way setup works. I didn't know, and correct me, maybe the other person misinformed me, that when you flop or reveal your cards, that happens actually exactly simultaneously, and there isn't an order to it. And I always thought that there was an order like other action windows.
Yeah, this is a great topic because we were just talking about the setup analyzer. The setup phase actually has a lot more intricacies to it than you'd think, and even the pre-game, you know, basically nobody plays it right, which isn't to say that everybody's doing it wrong. They're just not doing it according to the rule book. So when you first sit down from your opponent, you're supposed to, you know, flip a coin or find some way to determine the first player. And, you know, most people don't do this. You just reveal your house and agenda, and you shuffle your deck, and you drop your cards. But even that stage can be really very important in a tournament match. One of the examples I'm thinking of is a House of Dreams location.
Yeah, absolutely. If I was, like, maybe House of Dreams Stark with Bear Island, I'd love to know that you were running Stark or not Stark before I picked my location. But if I lost the flip, I'd have to reveal before you would House and agenda, and then I'd have to make my decision based on zero information.
Yeah, so that's right. And so this is the case of very important for House of Dreams, because picking, you know, Iron Hall over Bear Island or picking Dragon Pit over Aegon's Hill based on who you're facing can be really quite important. But the next stage is just as important, the number of cards you set up. Placing cards into setup does not happen simultaneously. The first player takes his hand and decides whether or not to mulligan. He does. The second player takes his hand, decides whether or not to mulligan, and so on. And then the first player, who has kept his hand, places his setup cards. And then the second player places his setup cards. So if your plot deck includes a plot like that uses cards at your command, for instance, like the Red Wine Straits, and you see your opponent set up five cards, go ahead and set up four. You're still going to get your extra four gold off that.
Yeah, that's huge. It's a lot of information to be able to see how many cards your opponent's setting up before you have to do your own.
I think it's quite important. Now, you don't get to mulligan after that. Each player has to pass their mulligan, and then you get to set up. But if you're trying to duck under cards at your command, that's a really good example of when this can come into play. And it's something that nobody does.
And I know we once talked about, you know, poker tells and stuff. And something that I notice a lot, especially on setup, is I get a lot of information from a setup about the way people organize their cards. People love to put their characters up top, their locations behind. You know, they'll have like three in a row, and then they'll have these two characters up top, part that. And you instantly know from this setup what they're holding. And that can be also useful information for someone, especially if the other person went first at their setup and now it's your turn, and you see these this way that they always set up their cards.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess I still haven't answered your original question about setup reveal. The setup reveal is odd because it actually happens simultaneously. So once everyone has placed their cards in setup, then everybody reveals simultaneously. And this is an odd sort of place in the rules because if you have a setup attachment, you don't have to know which character it's going to attach to. It just has to have a legal target. And I guess I can... Well, maybe I'll hold on the aside and mention it afterwards. But so if you have an attachment, you could potentially wait to see what your opponent has revealed to decide which character that goes on. But then again, so could they. So it's sort of a gray area in the rules. So I wouldn't know exactly how to handle it. I've specifically asked K-Tom about it once, and he said that essentially it is one of those gray areas, like cards going into the discard pile. If someone plays Westeros Bleeds, all of your characters and all of your opponents are hitting the discard pile. As the controller, you get to choose the order in which they go into yours, but you might want to adjust the order they go into yours based on the order they went into his, right?
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, the rules don't allow for that. They go in simultaneously. So maybe the best way is to hide your play field when you have attachments and then put them in there and wait until he's prepared his, and I don't know exactly how you want to do it. The rules don't allow for it. But setup still has some other points to it. I mean, the rule book is fairly clear about certain things that keep coming up. Come into play effects don't matter on setup. So your Ned Stark from the core set that nobody plays, but your Iron Cliffs from Greyjoy that, you know, when they come into play get 2 gold, setting them up means you've just set up a dead card. They don't get that 2 gold.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, that's one of the easier interactions. There are some trickier bits. Something that I've often seen players, especially with House of Dreams, do, Lanny House of Dreams will set up a increased levy. And they'll do it when they don't have any locations in their setup because they think that their House of Dreams locations counts, and it doesn't. And even if you happen to have a location in your setup, and then when you reveal, you have to attach the increased levy to one of the locations in your setup, not to your House of Dreams location. That House of Dreams location does not form a part of your setup. It's something that I've often seen played wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that all the time.
I guess one more point that sort of confused me. People have often been talking about using the Maesters, for instance, the Apprentice Callers and other callers. The callers have a restriction. They're setup cards, but they can only be placed on a Maester. And so the question is often, if I have a non-Maester and an Apprentice Caller in my setup, can I also place, Copper Link or something?
And I guess from what you just described a second ago, the answer would be no, because you wouldn't have a legal target immediately for the other chain.
And that's entirely right. You cannot place that Copper Link if there isn't an actual printed Maester in your setup. Now, the question gets even trickier, though, if you imagine a situation where you do have a printed Maester and you have a card that isn't a Maester, and you have an Apprentice Caller and a Copper Link. Now, that's a perfectly legitimate setup. When you reveal it, can you put the Apprentice Caller on the non-Maester and then put the Copper Link on the non-Maester?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't, and the answer is actually no. The answer is there isn't really an order in which the attachments are put, so you can't really put them in order to allow them to be attached. But, I mean, we're starting to get into the nitty-gritty, and this is going to come up one time in a million. If you really want a take-home message from this segment, it's to make sure that you're assigning the first player before your setup, so that you can count the number of cards he sets up, so that you can see what his house is before you choose your House of Dreams location. Those are much more likely to be relevant than the nitty-gritty of these setup details.
See that? Talk with Alex, learn something new.
Oh, or just listen to him babble and have no idea why he bothered.
All right, today we're joined by guest Aaron Glazer, the winner of the DC Store Championship. And for those that don't know, Washington, D.C. is one of the strongest metas around. So, Aaron, what's your experience in Thrones?
Well, I've been playing competitively since last June. A couple months in, I won the New York Regional. Gen Con and Worlds are the only tournaments I ever missed the cut in. I've been top 8 or top 4 and everything else. And I placed top 3 in the first 2 Store Championships I went to this year.
So what meta would you consider yourself a part of?
Oh, I'm absolutely New York meta. I think I'm one of the more vocal members of it because I don't know how to shut up. So it's really like Dave Thrones and I talking an awful lot.
So yeah, to put in context what John said about the DC meta, they tend to get quite a reputation, both partly because they win a lot, but you've seen their names and faces on cards like the Blackfish, House of Dreams, the new agenda, Dark Rings, Dark Words, and as far as I know, Eric still has a card design awaiting from an overall championship that still hasn't been released.
That he does.
Right, and they used to have some great players like
Steve Simone. Who also has a card design, yeah.
Yeah, so they had quite a big wins. Personally, Eric's one of my big nemesises, and I can't wait to hear how you beat him in this tournament, Aaron.
And I can't wait to hear the word nemesises again.
Unfortunately, I didn't get to play Eric. He is now retired. So.
No, that's not possible. I heard something circulating that he was supposedly retired, but I knew that was actually propaganda aimed mostly at me to, you know, so I'd have less of a guard so that when he shows up at a major event, I won't be ready for it. So you're lying, right? He was there?
He was absolutely there. He ran the tournament. He's, I don't know the guy well. He's as happy and relaxed as I've ever seen him. So good for him. But yeah, we're going to get a beer soon. He's a really good guy.
He actually is a really good guy. I'm really disappointed to hear that he's retired from Thrones, though. That's too bad.
He'll still play casually. He played some pickup games. He destroyed people because he's a phenomenal player. And yeah, but he's done with the competitive scene, at least for the time being.
Wow.
So this tournament was last week, so for listeners it'll be like 9 days prior to this episode. So what kind of prep did you do going into this tournament? What did you expect to see, and why did you choose the deck you did?
Well, I've got an obnoxious bet with DC Dennis about winning some store championships with Bloodthirst. I played that at my first 2 store championships, and playing that for about 15, 16 hours got really draining. So my decision was, I've been playing Siege in the Octagon tournament, and it's 5-1. The only loss is to Simone's Worlds deck, which is Barra Black Sails. It was second at Worlds. And I figured that was a pretty good bit going for it. The other strongest decks in the meta are Lani No Agenda, which Siege completely eats alive, and Barra Hollow Hill, and Siege destroys that. So I decided to go with it.
So I actually want to talk to you about that, because most people would generally say that Lani No Agenda is a pretty strong counter to Siege of Winterfell. So why do you feel that's not the case?
Lani No Agenda has absolutely... Well, Lani No Agenda can kneel out a bit, but Lani No Agenda is not kneeling out the 8 or 9 characters I'm spitting out on the board. And I really don't care about killing their guys. All I really do care about is winning that military challenge and getting the power.
Right, and you have, normally in Siege decks at least, and I'm looking at yours right now actually, you normally have a lot of plots that let you control their use of locations, and that's one of the big strengths of Lani No Agenda, right?
Hey, they have a ton, but I really only need the 2 plots to control their locations. It's a rush deck, so controlling that for 2 plots is already going to get me to 9 to 11 power, especially with epic phases.
So, go ahead, you chose to run what 2 plots?
Dry Season, this is actually you guys' call. Originally, this deck was totally yours, and I ended up changing. People better at math than I have told me that it's about 70% your deck, 30% mine now.
I think at that point, it's no longer the same deck.
Yeah, it's not. It's your deck. If it's that big of a change, trust me. That's a big change for a deck.
Fair enough. But we've got Dry Season, which is phenomenal against that deck, and it really slows down Barra Hollow Hill's influence curve. And Burning Bridges, which shuts off Kentoshi, the Iron Throne, and pretty much everything else that could give me a problem.
Yeah, and it shuts down a lot of their Neil too, right, because it's character-based, so, again. Yeah. I am looking at your plots, and there's one thing that I see that March to the Wall. Now, that one right there seems like a strange choice to me. What made you decide to put that in?
Wildfire was originally in that spot, and the more I played the deck, the more I realized I just didn't care about clearing the, like, getting down to three characters didn't do anything for me. They were never having much more than four or five out anyway. I was hitting them too hard. But when I did almost clear their board, they'd almost always, like, manage to keep a Tywin or a Cersei just sitting around giving me headaches. March to the wall, I'm tossing away a hungry mob, and they're losing their best character. And no one sees it coming, so they feel like they're safe when they have that one character left.
Hmm. Did you get any mileage out of March to the Wall in your climb up to victory?
I got a good bit of mileage. It got rid of a King Robert. Not for good, obviously, because it's Barra. But it cleared him out, and then it wasn't Amell's scheme's turn, so they weren't able to see who's stronger. What else did I throw away? I think I got rid of... I want to say... was a good Stark character. I don't remember exactly who. It wasn't Brienne, but it was a strong Stark character as well. It didn't get rid of any strong Lannister characters here, but in the Octagon tournament, it's hit all sorts of good stuff. From Magister Illyria, the burn one,
yes,
who's given me all sorts of fits. Basically everyone. It's hit the Red Viper once or twice. It's basically fantastic.
Awesome. Your event base, I'm looking at the deck again, seems pretty standard. So you're running basically 9 epic battles so that you can get more military challenges. Was there anything special about these that you thought, or do you think they were pretty standard?
It was mostly standard. What was different is a lot of people run Battle of Ruby Ford and War of Five Kings. And I think both of those are absolutely terrible choices for this kind of deck. You need to control your rush, and Ruby Ford and War of the Five Kings take that control out of your hands. With Ruby Ford, you're very often giving up 2 claim power and entry challenges, severely slowing you down, especially when you want to negotiate next turn. And the entire deck's focus is on its plot, so War of the Five Kings taking that away just destroys me. Shield Islands has given me quite a few House of Dreams locations over my games with it, including a Tunnels of the Red Keep, though. So that makes it more than worth it. And at this tournament, gave me an Iron Throne as well.
That's golden. That's always good to see. I want to focus in on a card that when I first faced off against it, I was convinced it was terrible until it destroyed me. And I've since included it in almost every Stark deck I've built, and that's Borderlands Keep. I absolutely love this card, and I can understand why people's first instinct looking at it is, no, this is crap. Aaron, tell me why it's not crap.
You don't want to be stopped. Burning on the Sand, Red Vengeance, late challenge, Kneel actions, anything that could happen during a military, you just ignore it. It doesn't matter to you. It's most useful, as far as I've seen, for just getting Serio back into shadows to be completely obnoxious every epic phase. But every problem that comes up during a military challenge, it's almost like a mini Brienne location, as long as they don't have 8 different cancels, which Bloodthirst will. But short of that, it gets you past your trouble spots and into more power.
The person I first saw run that was actually Derek Shoemaker, and he ran it at Worlds in his Stark Knight deck, and I had playtested with him a bit before Worlds, and I had seen its power at that point. Ever since then, I agree, Alex, that I've been including it in my Stark decks that are based for around military challenges. I think that was a great call, Aaron.
I mean, in Rush like this, it gets those challenges through in aggro versions of Stark. It cancels saves. It's just so versatile, and it's just a threat while it's on the board, too. And a good setup card, too.
One more card needs a shout-out, absolutely, because it was complete money all day. Vanguard Scouts are phenomenal.
Oh, I like those, yeah. Those were in my version initially as well.
Yep.
They weren't in my version.
They're so amazing during epic phases. I could care less about them during the regular challenge phase. I don't even play them if I don't have an epic out, unless I really need to stand. They come out, they sit there for every epic phase, and they just cause nightmares for opponents. There's nothing they can do to stop them. They're expensive enough to stick on the board. 3 strength doesn't kneel for the first challenge, and every epic phase, they just don't kneel and stand there being mean.
So tell us a little bit about your climb to the top. This is a very tough field, the toughest in North America. I think that might be fair to say.
It's among the tougher. Okay, so I walked in, and all I saw everyone setting up were a bunch of different Barrow Hollow Girls. Some with army, some with shadow, some somewhere in between. I had actually just built a sandy Barrow Hollow Hill based off the Stalic Winter the night before, and Siege just eats it up. Barrow Hollow Hill has no answer and no chance against Siege. So immediately I was like, okay, well, I'm at least placing here. My first game was against Barrow Hollow Hill Army, he had no chance and didn't get out of the gate. I then played a Stark Song of Ice, which was just a really weird deck. He was really cocky, like he was going to destroy me. I think he thought Siege was terrible. And he lasted three turns. I then played Seth's Lannister No Agenda. That's the game I took the duped Iron Throne. One of my play mistakes of the day, I managed to mess up and not have not play an epic twice, or that would have been a quick win, but since I didn't, it took forever. Round four is the really interesting one. I played Corey's Bloodthirst, and along with Alvaro, Corey is one of the two best players I've ever sat across the table from, and he absolutely creamed me. My only loss of the day, and he just eat me up.
See, it's a very bad idea to run up against Corey in the first four rounds, because as far as I know, he always 4-0 drops.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right after beating me, that's what he did.
Yeah, he's an extremely strong player, but he doesn't like some of the competitive scene, and he says that he starts to get tired after a while, and it's less fun. But yeah, he's awesome. So that's too bad for you, Aaron, but at least you know that you're not going to have to face him again.
I tried to convince him to stay in the tournament. I figured if he's that good, he should win it, and he just had absolutely no interest, as is his general motif.
Four rounds of Swiss, or was there another round after that?
Round of Swiss, I played Patrick, who actually knocked me out of the tournament the day before with Greyjoy Black Sails. That day, he was playing Barra Black Sails, basically the Simone build, which is the only loss the deck has ever had in competitive play. But he never got off the blocks, and I was able to pretty quickly shut him down. In the cut, I then played Seth again with his Lightning No Agenda. He played much better this time, knew more what to expect, and managed to hold me off for a bit with his Neil. But ultimately, a Borderlands Keep on an Iron Throne, putting Serio back into Shadows for several epic phases, won me the game. And
so before you go into that, so this was a longer game, and this is something that I think a lot of people don't think of when they think of Siege. Siege actually has some staying power, especially your version, with the ability to refill your hand. Did you ever play longer games other than this one?
I've played quite a few long games. I've gone to 8 and 9. It plays fine. It's absolutely unbelievable how important the Guard at River Run is. Just when that card comes alone is fantastic. If I need negotiations, and I have a Guard at River Run out, I know I'll be set. Or I added a few Kingsguard characters. I have Eris to stand for Epics, Preston, because popping in the Shadows is great, and a single Jamie, because Renown is great. Being able to punch in the Epics with Renown is phenomenal. And that one extra card coming toward the end of the phase gives me a negotiations fund. I only need that one card to be able to last 9-10 plus.
I think one of the major advantages of the negotiations, because I know that Fear of Winter tends to be a popular restricted for Siege, but negotiations is a plot, and therefore you can actually cycle your hand at that point, get more epic battles, and play them right then and there. And I think that also makes a huge difference.
Well, I like this version much better than the Fear of Winter version for another reason, and that's Art of Seduction. Art of Seduction wins me more games than absolutely anything else. By the end of turn 2 or so, they should have to Valar if you're doing your job right with this deck. And if they have to Valar, and you are the Seduction that Valar, you're going to win. They have no way of possibly stopping you with 0 points for 2 turns. If they have to Valar, and they don't Valar, and you are the Seduction so they can't Valar, you're going to win, because now they're stuck and can't get rid of all your good stuff on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Art is one of the best plots in the game, and I have no idea why it's in this place or wherever.
All right, so sorry I interrupted you, and you were moving towards the finals here.
In the finals, I played the deck I actually built the night before, the Baron Knights of the Hollow Hill, with Sandy playing it. He piloted excellently. It's like the second or third time he played it, I knew it was right up his alley. He refused to play it for 3 months because he loves spiting me. Finally played it, made it to the finals, and Siege eats Knights of the Hollow Hill of all shapes and sizes. It's just, it takes too long to get going, and I have too much power by the time it does. He was able to stall a bit with the only game that matters, but I got King Rob out to stop his King Robert, and that just put an end to it.
So with this new experience, because you played, you know, maybe 7-8 games that day, is there anything in the deck you change, or you just leave it exactly as it is?
I keep going back and forth on whether I want a Blackfish, and I've ultimately landed on no. The strength of the deck is that I can put out a lot of characters. Even First Snow doesn't really stop that, thank you Forgotten Plans. But enough of them have free strength or live in the shadows of something else that the character base is very, very tight, and even Blackfish doesn't fit. I'm going to have to figure out a way to get the new Blackfish in because he'll accelerate the deck enough.
Yeah, he will be fun.
Yeah, man, I don't think so.
And so, if someone's to sit across the table from your deck, how would they beat it?
That's the trick. Bloodthirst. You have to have remarkable draw early and be able to stall me out with that draw. There's no deck besides Bloodthirst that I can really think of right now that does it. A perfectly drawn Lammy Neal. But
you probably don't want to see something like a Viper's Bannerman hit the table on turn one or something either.
Viper's Bannerman are annoying. They'd actually probably be really annoying out of Quentin. I bet you Quentin would be a terrible matchup, but I haven't actually had that one yet because everyone on Earth but you guys needs to stop playing Quentin. So thanks for that.
Yeah, nah, my experience with Siege was Quentin was not a particularly good matchup for it.
Everyone's standing slows it so much.
Yeah,
that's what I found too, is it slows it, and if he got a second Viper's Bannerman, or if he searched out, like, if he drew one and then searched one out, and he had two Viper's Bannermen on the table, my Siege just kind of went, blah. And I cried a little inside.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know how to really stop that. I guess you have to just hope the epics that you have enough standing, but then they can't have Quentin, otherwise you're screwed.
All right, so you're still playing this deck then in the Octagon Tournament.
I am, and I really made the cut. Like, I'm ranked 8th or 9th on the tournament,
mm-hmm.
So even with the loss in the last round, I'll be playing it in the cut.
You're going to let us post it anyways, though, right? Because you're not afraid of anything?
Nope. It's all yours.
Woohoo!
All right. Excellent.
So, Alex, everyone's probably listened to 30 minutes to a fantastic episode of Beyond the Wall, but they're all probably wondering, what was it that he was talking about at the very beginning? What was this big announcement?
Well, I'm really, really excited to bring this to you guys. We've actually managed to secure an interview with Nate French, who's the lead designer for the Game of Thrones card game. So we've been working on this for a little while and going back and forth with Nate to schedule a time, and all of this stuff is coming together. We can't really guarantee when that episode's going to air because we need to actually, you know, sit down for the interview and, you know, edit it and make sure that everything we air is okay with FFG. But we have some really exciting questions in mind, and I think it's going to be our best episode yet. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it.
Alex just said Nate French, the god of AGOT. I'm excited.
Well, yeah, and I think it also makes us appear even more legitimate. I mean, this week we were mentioned officially on the FFG website, and in a couple of weeks we'll have, you know, official recognition from Nate French. It almost makes us feel like we're not just two people in our basements recording. Well, I'm not in my basement, nor are you.
Me neither.
We're good. Okay. We're not sad, pathetic, and lonely losers.
Yeah, we're both married. We're good. Well, sorry, women. Sorry, girls.
Yeah, sorry, ladies. In addition to that, I actually have a request to make of our listener base. So people have been subscribing to our RSS feed. People have been posting comments. It's fantastic. People have been emailing us. Keep doing that. I love seeing feedback about our episodes. I love having ideas. We've got people that sent us ideas for segments that we're hunting down the right people to interview. It's going to be great. But one specific point I'd like to have you guys do is, if you listen to this show, please like us on Facebook. We actually get some very interesting stats from the people that like us on Facebook. You know how I like stats. But we also have a way to communicate with you guys, post announcements in real time where you're likely to be able to see them. And I'd really like to be able to use that Facebook place as a place to communicate with the podcast. And in that vein, I'm also going to take a listener suggestion. I tend to be known as a bit of a rules lawyer. We've mentioned this before. If you have a rules question that you'd like to have us address on the cast, post it on the Facebook page for other people to see as well. Now, it doesn't really matter what the question is. I won't just answer the question. I'm going to go into the why. I'm going to give other examples, things that are related to it. So even if the question is simple, if it's one where you don't really understand why the answer is whatever it is, I'd be happy to go into it, and it'll be a place where we can start collecting that information and air it on the cast.
Awesome.
Any closing comments, John?
Nope, nothing. I think we've covered it all. Nate French.
Nate French. All right, see you guys all next week.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.